Lone Wolf Radio calling. Lone Wolf Radio calling. This is Lone Wolf Radio calling, and this is Terrible Tommy Metzger in the bunker right here in hot Southern California. Artificially hot. We've got fires all around out here. Boy, I'll tell you. And the winds? I lived here 40 years before I went back to Indiana, and I've experienced some Santana winds, but nothing like running around here today. Everything's shaking. Everything's flying across the street and garbage cans and everything else. Wow. Anyhow, that's what's going on today on the 7th of December 2017. I'm going to read you an article here that I received. In fact, I received several very interesting articles from someone who's actually in the old Behind the Iron Curtain. But this is about Western politics in the early 50s in Germany. And now this is in a liberal magazine, so it's obviously going to be a little slanted. Stealing the appeals and trappings of Hitlerism, the Reds revive an old German dream of a strong, united fatherland. Already they have a powerful following in the Allied zone. If Adolf Hitler suddenly turned up in Germany tomorrow, he'd probably be either arrested, lynched, or both. The Germans don't like a loser. They figure that Hitler's blunders lost them the war. Adolf has become the scapegoat for all their post-war troubles. But the crazy house painter's mystic martial philosophy lives on deep in the hearts of most Germans, who still dream of a strong, united fatherland, feared and respected throughout the world. This is as true of West Germany, where a dozen or more neo-Nazi parties have mushroomed in the past year, as of Soviet Germany, where the Russians have shrewdly and cynically adapted most of the trappings of Hitlerism to their own uses. This makes resurgent Nazis in Western Germany doubly dangerous. They watch with unconcealed envy the freewheeling latitude their old brown shirt pals enjoyed under the Russians, while they themselves could run afoul of the Western Allied regulations and be put out of business. The Nazis aren't curbed in Western Germany, they are just frustrated. That's why they find so much tempting appeal in the Soviet German system. I remember here just a few years ago, there was a big explosion of the white racist skinheads in East Germany, long before they were getting that popular in the West. One day last May, we stood on a sidewalk in Berlin's Soviet sector and watched a parade of stern-faced young Germans of the communist Free Deutschland Youth, part of the 3 million-strong blue-shirted members of an organization that was built on the ashes of the notorious Hitler Youth. Preceding them were banners, trumpets, kettle drums, and so forth. Yeah, I've got to do something here. Preceding them were banners, trumpets. Behind marched row after row after row of bronzed, husky soldiers in the black uniform of the Bereitschaften, Soviet Germany's fast-growing shock troops. Our companion, a young West German who had once served in Hitler's youth movement, was fascinated. "It's amazing," he murmured. "It's just like the old days. Why, even the music's the same." West of the Iron Curtain, uniformed Germans don't swagger down the streets with the same assurance, not yet, but rabid Nazi demagogues like Karl Meissner, Franz Richter, and former Major General Otto Ernst Remmer can sound off to receptive audiences and do. Well, I've got Rammer's book. He sent it to me and he autographed it while he was alive. "We will invade the circus of traitors at Bonn," Rammer shouted to a cheering rally a few months ago. "And I give you the guarantee that in 2 years we will be in power." Curiously, though, that was the theme of the Russians and their Nazi stooges were expounding politely. They sneered at the Bonn government as an infamous collaboration with the enemies of the German people. Once the Reich is liberated, they pledge West German officials will be tried by the Soviet-type People's Court. Then, too, the newspapers in the Soviet zone devoted splashing headlines parroting Russian charges that the Jews are homeless wanderers and bourgeois cosmopolitans, unquote. Jews attempting to flee Eastern Europe en route to Israel were arrested by black-uniformed East German Volkspolice, denounced as spies and returned to authorities in the Soviet satellites. At about the same time, Wolfgang Hedler, a deputy of the German party, which has 17 seats, just a minute, in the West German parliament, told a political meeting in Einfeld that it was perhaps unwise for Hitler to have sent the Jews to the gas chambers. Quote, "Other means could have been used to get rid of them," he added amid applause. Well, he sure could have. He could have just shipped them out. Don't forget that in last year's West German elections, all parties lost ground except the extreme right-wing groups like Hitler's outfit and even the more fervent German Right Party. Even a socialist like Kurt Schumacher, a veteran of the Nazi concentration camps, attacked the Western Allies and sang the glories of German nationalism in an effort to outbid the neo-Nazis for votes. He knew the temper of the people. It's interesting that I arrived in Germany not about the same time this was being talked about. I got there in 57, 50, No, yeah, 57. This was, they're talking about, I think, around 54. I don't see a dateline on this article. War criminals are back at their old jobs. Now you know why German people, working people, didn't want to bitch too much. Because a large percentage of the National Socialists got their old jobs back. Remember, too, that most of the 2 million odd Nazis who were tried and convicted in the West have served their terms or had them commuted. They're back in circulation again, most of them in their old jobs. American officials now estimate that more than half of West Germany's administrative offices are occupied by former Nazi Party members. In short, the totalitarian mentality is well entrenched in Germany and very much alive. No responsible Westerner who has worked and lived in that country for any length of time since the war can claim that these unhappy people have been democratized. I think that's how Merkel got in. See, Merkel was born and raised in East Germany. Communist East Germany. Socialist East Germany. So she was all set. She didn't have a problem. But she did change a lot of her positions drastically. This should surprise no one. It would be naive to expect as haughty and disciplined a nation as the Germans to grasp the meaning of democracy in 5 years, or ever, especially when democracy, as they observed it, was brought to them by a well-meaning but often bumbling military occupation. In Frankfurt, they tell a joke about three Germans arguing over which one is the best Democrat. The first one says it's because he was a Democrat even before Hitler came to power. The second claims the title for having been a Democrat even during the Hitler dictatorship. Quote, "You both lose," says the third. Quote, "I'm the best because after 5 years of instruction by the Western Allies on how to act like a Democrat, I'm still one." Neo-Nazism in Germany is deplorable, but it poses no immediate threat to the West. Its significance just now lies in how the Russians are exploiting this totalitarian mentality on both sides of the Iron Curtain that bisects Germany. And today there is a real danger that the Soviet strategy is succeeding. German communist slogans stressing unity, independence, and withdrawal from all the occupation by all the occupation troops are being echoed in the West by the extreme right. Yeah, U.S. troops should have been out of there, 20, 30 years ago? It's ridiculous. I don't see why the Germans would put up with help finance all that crap. As Pastor Martin Niemöller said last year, quote, "Given the alternative of a continual split in Germany or the prospect of reuniting the country under another dictatorship, that of Russia, the German people would prefer to take their risk with communism." Interesting. But not misunderstood, because Germany was very pro-communist prior to World War II. I mean, a large percentage of the German people were moving in that direction. And if it hadn't been for Goebbels going up to Berlin and stealing all their mottos and speeches, they would have gone Marxist. "For Americans, the meaning is clear. In any showdown between the East and the West in Europe, the Nazi-led, communist-equipped army of the Soviet Germany proclaiming unification of the fatherland." Whoops, wait a minute. I got a problem here. I've run out. I'm trying to read this off the screen. They would find millions of ready supporters in the western half of the country. This conclusion is based on the year's travel in all four occupied zones of Germany, including Berlin. We talked with the Western officials, with communists and Germans in all walks of life. We came away feeling that Germany's resurgent Nazis will play ball with anyone who will help them build up a Fourth Reich. Well, I agree. That's strictly Machiavellian politics. And it can happen here, too. Knowing this, the Russians have long sought to make their zone the nucleus of a German state to which all patriotic Germans could rally. They've set up a German Democratic Republic, given it an army, and brayed about a united Germany. They've tried to bully the West out of Berlin and make it an all-German capital. Stalin hasn't forgotten Lenin's dictum that whoever controls Germany controls Europe. That's why Germany always scares the shit out of England, because England wants to be in control, and they know as long as Germany is there, they're not really in control. How effective this Soviet policy has been can be gauged by the response of the Germans world over. Last November, the Chicago Deutsche Amerikaner, official organ of the German American Citizens League of Illinois, splashed an open letter to Stalin across six columns of its front page. Quote, "We're actually predestined for an alliance with Moscow," said the letter, "all the more so since the mutual cooperation with the closed bloc of the Soviet states interests us millions of people educated in strict discipline more than dancing along with the constantly changing representatives of the parliamentary countries of the West. The author, Bruno Frick, was a close collaborator of Otto Strasser. There we go, the Strasser boys again. A former Nazi who broke with Hitler for personal reasons. Well, I think it reminds me a lot of some of us who broke with Duke. Some of the same reasons. And now masterminds of the so-called League for German Revival from his home in Canada. This helps explain why the Russians have carefully avoided cracking down on big or little Nazis in their part of Germany. Knowing the German tendency to follow rabble-rousers, they are wisely concentrating on winning the potential rabble-rousers over to their side. A Red Stooge party has even been set aside for East German Nazis, ironically called the National Democratic Party. Former officers of the Nazi Wehrmacht not only run the new German Communist Army, but now comprise 52% of all ministers, state secretaries, police chiefs, and mayors in the Soviet zone. These men aren't the aristocratic type Prussian militarists who would be repelled by the proletariat overtones of the Soviet Germany. They are the new revolutionary type of disciplined thug created by Hitler. Among the more prominent are Leutpold, Seidler, Walter Bechler, Paul Markgraf, Vincent Mueller, Fritz Ruck, Dr. Ernest Hodderon, and former Major General Otto Korfus. Korfus is particularly interesting as one of Hitler's chief military theoreticians. He headed the Heer's Archive. Today he occupies his same desk in the Orangy Palace at Potsdam as chief of the Central Archives of the Soviet Zone, the outfit charged with tightening the bonds between Germany and Russia. Korfus integrated himself with the Russians during the war. When made a prisoner, he told his captors, it's tragic for, and I gotta go to another page, gonna take me a minute, if I can find it. I hate to work with zip files and this kind of stuff. I'm not used to it. This is probably sort of disjointed here because of the way it's laid out and trying to track them on the screen. But I think my webmaster is going to try to help me separate these pages so I can put them together so I can copy them and send them out to people. Anyhow, I'll read what I see on the screen. I calls them the way I sees them. That's the way Red Skelton used to say. American authorities are trying to create a unified democratic Germany by legitimate means. They are trying to fulfill a promise to the Germans of eventual self-government. That's big of them. Individual freedom and a chance to win back their country's place in a community of peace-loving nations. What a bunch of bullshit that is. They're trying to fulfill that promise in spite of the Russian opposition, the indifference and hostility of many Germans, and their own uncertainties and mistakes. It is a discouraging assignment, but the American authorities have not compromised with principles. Boy, that's a bunch of... Forget I read that. Anyhow, this all took place. These articles were written in 1950, I found out. 1950. Just 4 years after... 5 years after the war ended. And I got there in 56, 57. There doesn't seem to be any answer to America's long-range problem in Germany except to continue the country's education in democracy. Going to educate them in democracy. Haven't we heard? Weren't we going to do that in Syria and Iraq, all those places? Even if it means indefinite occupation. Yeah, of course. It did mean indefinite occupation. But it does seem that our government might take more positive action against the immediate dangers that confront it. We think it ought to crack down on the neo-Nazi parties that have sprung up in the West, and we think it should arm the Western Germany unless the Russians agree to disarm their so-called police forces in the Eastern Zone. Earlier we said that Germany was potentially another Korea, but the problem of Western Germany, unlike the problem of South Korea, can't be settled simply by giving it tanks, guns, and planes. There is a grave risk in arming West Germans, the risk that they might not fight well in a civil war for a free government that many of them apparently don't want, or risk what they might go over, that they might go over to the Russian side. But it is calculated risk which we believe should be taken. Sure, a defenseless Western Germany is a rich prize which the covetous Russians are training their Nazi stooges to pluck for them. You begin to see how this anti-Putin, anti-Russian crap just keeps coming down the pike. We can see no virtue in attempting further Soviet aggression by the same inaction that brought on the Korean War. And here's an editorial from the same magazine. New tailor, same old suit. The chief purpose of this editorial, or perhaps this postscript, is to call attention to the report from two members of Collier's European team, which appeared on page 22 under the title of The Nazis March Again, this time for Stalin. It is an illuminating and disturbing account, and if you haven't read it already, you ought to now. Then, if you're interested in our further thoughts on the matter, you can read on from here. It's quite natural that most of us in and out of government have been thinking and talking about Korea and Far East in recent months. But that occupation should not make Americans forget that Germany is potentially another Korea, only on a bigger and more dangerous scale. The situation is much the same as it was in the cozy period of the Hitler-Stalin agreement back in 1939. Only then the Russians and the Germans were strong and mutually suspicious neighbors. Today Stalin is the undisputed boss of half of Germany, and he has been trying by every means short of war to control the whole country. One of those means is the increasing use of the remnants of Hitler's party. The Russians aren't bothered by scruples. With a cynical disregard for consistency, they have perverted the Nazi philosophy to their own advantage. They flatter and pamper the former Nazis and use them to subjugate the people of Soviet Germany. Probably this strange performance doesn't strike the majority of Germans as being so very inconsistent at that, for there isn't much difference between the Russian communism and German Nazism. But there's a lot of difference between both of those and then Jewish democracy. In spite of superficial variations, they were cut from the same bolt of authoritarian cloth. The citizen of Soviet Germany is living in much the same sort of political world as the one that Hitler created, although physically it is much less comfortable. It is still a world of slogans and parades and uniforms, of phony elections and strict discipline, spies and secret police. The American government's tough job is to block the Russians' intentions of seizing all of Germany, and at the same time foster democracy and root out still vigorous growth of Nazism in its own zone. In trying to do this job, the government is at something of a disadvantage because it is honest. Propaganda, man, propaganda. We're good guys. Everybody else is bad guys. I can't get it out of my head that this Andrew Anglin with this website of his is a plant, is not a plant. Now he's going after Jewish women specifically. Prominent neo-Nazi says troll storm meant to harass Jewish women is protected by the First Amendment. I don't know, boys and girls, it's becoming pretty plain to me what this guy is. Those are not winning tactics in 2017. They might have been winning tactics partially back in the 30s and early 40s in Germany, but not now. And who was that guy? Was the mayor of, I forget now. The one that put all that wild-ass cartoons out in Germany under Hitler. Hitler finally had to shove him aside. He got too wild. I think that's what this guy's doing. The guy was the mayor of Nuremberg. I forget his name right now. Anyhow, if somebody could tell me what advantage it is to using this kind of attack approach, let me know. I put out a lot of racial cartoons, but that was in the old days. They're still good cartoons, don't get me wrong. But I think they outlived their day and were not that effective as tactics. The press are calling this Andrew Anglin a prominent neo-Nazi. A prominent neo-Nazi. Well, I see that a grand dragon. I don't know whether this just happened or not. The KKK was forced out of the Klan for marrying a 15-year-old girl. The Alabama Grand Dragon of the Ku Klux Klan, Alvin Horn, 45, of Talladega, has resigned in the turmoil and uproar following his marriage to a teenager. His resignation was announced Monday by Eldon Lee Edwards, Atlanta Imperial Wizard of the U.S. Klan's Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, I guess he's like Harvey Weinstein, huh? Only on not so big a scale. Well, here's a story about that fellow Jones, I think his name is, running against the Judge Moore down south, convicted of murder in the deadliest attack of the civil rights era. The one time Ku Klux Klansman glowered when the judge asked him if he had anything to say before going to prison for the 1963 church bombing that killed four black girls. Bobby Frank Cherry pointed at the prosecution table that included Doug Jones. Quote, "This whole bunch lied all the way through this thing," unquote, Cherry said in a deep southern drawl. "I told the truth, and I don't know why I'm going to jail for nothing." 15 years after Cherry snarled at Jones, the bombing is still echoing in Alabama's fractious Senate race. Now the Democratic nominee Jones is touting a record that includes the prosecutions of Cherry and another one-time Klansman, Thomas Blanton Jr., as he asked voters in the Republican-run Alabama to turn on GOP nominee Roy Moore and give him a try. "I still believe those cases were on the right side of history," he told reporters after a stop in Montgomery. "I believe that this campaign is on the right side of history and the people that are ready to move forward and rather than backwards." Yes, let's see here. There's a little more of this. Moore and his supporters are depicting Jones as an out-of-touch, Obama-loving liberal who is soft on issues, including crime. The tactic could work based on the state's history. Conservative white Republicans dominate the electorate in Alabama. No Democrat holds a statewide office, and President Donald Trump's carried more than 60% of the state vote last year. The president offered up his unwavering support of Moore in a tweet Monday, despite the sexual assault allegations that have rocked Moore's campaign. What about his falsely causing the conviction of Cherry, the Klansman, who was probably totally innocent? Jones touts his leading role in closing the books as on an act so cruel it helped open the nation's eyes to the depth of racial hatred in the Jim Crow South. They like to use that term, Jim Crow. While Jones is appealing to the voters on what he calls kitchen table issues, including health care, jobs, and education, don't they all? The church bombing prosecution is always in the background. Jones' supporter, Michelle Summers Hines, said she learned about the Birmingham church bombing growing up in Chicago, so the black woman was all the more inclined to back the one-time U.S. attorney for Senate. When I came here, I knew about four little girls, said Summer Hines, 47, of Montgomery. It must be a girlfriend of Morris D's. The bombing happened during a year when the deeply segregated Birmingham was the epicenter of a campaign to end racial segregation. Months after protests in which the police and firefighters used dogs and fire hoses to turn back black agitators trying to march in downtown streets, KKK members, under cover of darkness, planted a bomb outside a thick brick wall of the 16th Street Baptist Church, a leading black congregation in a deeply segregated city. The bomb went off on the morning of September 15, 1963, a Sunday, and blasted a huge hole in the church at almost the exact spot the five young women were in a restroom getting ready for worship. You get ready for worship in a restroom? The explosion killed 11-year-old Denise McNair. Well, blah, 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 blah. Investigators soon had a list of Klan suspects that included Cherry and Blanton, plus Robert Chambliss and Herman Frank Cash. Wonder if he was related to Johnny Cash. All were active in a Klan group with a reputation for violence. The Chambliss had a nickname to match, Dynamite Bob. The investigation went cold for years until then Alabama Attorney General Bill Baxby reopened the probe and led the prosecution of Chambliss, who was convicted in 77 and died in prison in 85. The case went dormant again, and the fact of other suspects were never prosecuted became an increasingly sore point within Birmingham's black community. Then FBI agent Robert Langford heard complaints during a meeting with black pastors in 1993, and a renewed investigation was underway at the time when President Bill Clinton appointed Jones as a U.S. attorney in Birmingham in 1997. See how these creeps all run together? Blanton and Cherry, who had moved to Texas from Alabama, were indicted on state murder charges in 2000, and Jones received a special appointment to oversee the prosecution. He led a team of federal and state attorneys during the trials that resulted in the convictions of Blanton in 2001 and Cherry the following year. Prosecutors used both of the men's own words to convict them. Don't they usually? Guys talk too much. Cherry had talked about the bombing through the years. Evidence showed and secretly recorded FBI tapes from decades earlier captured Blanton talking about the bombing with his then wife and a Klan buddy who turned informant. That's the way that goes. If you're involved in something like that, you never can talk. Cherry denied that he participated in the bombing. He died in prison within 3 years of being convicted. Blanton remains behind bars. Alabama's parole board refused to release him in August 2016 after a hearing that concluded Jones advocating for Blanton to remain incarcerated. There you go. Cash died in 1994. He was never charged. Yeah. They'll probably never let the guy out. That fifth little girl who survived the bombing, Sarah Rudolph, is now among Joan's most ardent supporters, and so is her husband. We're going to vote for him, absolutely. He convicted the church bombers, said George Rudolph. Well, there you go. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. You notice how ugly cars are getting? I mean, it's off the subject, but once in a while they'll flash a new car onto my screen that I haven't asked for. And most of them, especially the small cars, are downright ugly. There's no real style or class to them. I mean, have you seen a Cadillac lately? It looks like a Toyota. The only way you can get a decent-looking car is to buy a 20-year-old car, at least. Well, they're bringing up some of the same stuff they brought up when Duke was running for governor down there in Louisiana. The concern, though, also offers the roots of a political argument, one that's seen some success in other conservative locals, including Louisiana, when former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke made the 1991 gubernatorial runoff against Edwin Edwards. One of the more effective arguments against Duke was that his ascent would isolate the state economically. They've been using this kind of argument for quite some time, and it works. The corporations, I want you to understand, some of your main, possibly your main enemy is the corporate America, the corporate state. They're running everything and they're influencing everything, even down to whether a football team is going to be in your state. More recently, similar campaigns bolstered by big business have staved off laws that would have given private businesses license to discriminate, in other words, to be free, against gay couples in Indiana and restricted bathroom use by transgendered freak people in Texas. Louisiana actually benefited from the passage of such a law in North Carolina when the NBA relocated its years all-star game from Charlotte to New Orleans in protest. They've been using that a lot. It's time to turn off the tax spigot for these big coliseums. Don't finance them at all. Let the niggers find their own place to play basketball. League leaders cited the city's progressive policies. I love it when they say, that, well, corporations talk about progressive politics or liberal politics, and Governor John Bel Edwards' non-discrimination executive order, which he's had to defend in court against Attorney General Jeff Landry, as positive signals. Goes back to the corporations, boys and girls. One upside to this approach is that it sidesteps party politics and aims straight at economic self-interest. In other words, threatening your livelihoods. It also offers Alabamians the chance to decide and tell the world if electing this horribly flawed candidate is really more important than declaring the state open for business. Well, you know how that goes. Pretty soon it's just going to be straight fascist, Italian, corporate state. That's what it's going to be. Well, this is interesting, too. Texas prisoners aren't allowed to read Where's Waldo, but are permitted to leaf through books by the former Ku Klux Klan Grand Wizard David Duke. More than 10,000 books are off-limits to the state's nearly 150,000 prisoners. A list of the blocked texts obtained by the Dallas Morning last week shows... Let me see here. Forbidden books, including Alice Walker's Pulitzer Prize-winning The Color Purple, which chronicles the life of an African-American woman living in the South who endures abuse. It is blocked because it contains incest. Also blocked is Freakonomics, a 2005 chart topper. Inmates can't read Where's Waldo, Santa Spectacular, because it contains stickers, according to the report. Homer Simpson's little book of laziness and Monty Python's Big Red Book are also restricted. Yeah. Among the 248,281 approved books inmates can instead choose from, such as the two by David Duke, Hitler's Mein Kampf, and On National Socialism and World Relations, and James Battersby, The Holy Book of Adolf Hitler, which is called by many the Bible of Neo-Nazism, of Esoteric Hitlerism, according to Google Books. The Texas Department of Criminal Justice bars books for several reasons, such as detailed descriptions of illegal sex acts, or information on criminal plans, according to the Dallas Morning News report. The book with covers that can be used to hide contraband are also blocked, which is why prisoners aren't allowed to read the pop-up book Harry Potter. Civil rights activists say inmates should be able to read whatever they want, whether it's Hitler or Walker. Quote, there's a lot of rights prisoners give up, but they shouldn't have to give that one up, Terry Burke, executive director of the Texas Division of American Civil Liberties Union, told the Dallas Morning News. Adolf Hitler and David Duke should be there just as much as Salman Rushdie and Alice Walker. Well, I agree with this liberal, this progressive. She's correct. They should be able to get any book they want. Especially Serpent's Walk by National Alliance. Well, the wealthiest 1% of American households owns 40% of the country's wealth, as usual, according to a new paper by economist Edward Wolfe. That share is higher than it has been at this point in 50 years, since 62, according to Wolfe's data, which comes from the Federal Survey of Consumer Finances. From 2013, the share of wealth owned by the 1% shot up nearly 3 percentage points. Wealth owned by the bottom 90%, meanwhile, fell over the same period. Today, the top 1% of households own more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. That gap between the unwealthy, the ultra-wealthy, and everyone else has only become wider in the past several decades. And still, there's nobody in the streets. Nobody in the streets, man. Well, I've about run out of good stuff for today, boys and girls, so I'm going to take an early exit here and be back with you tomorrow. I've got some real interesting stuff for you tomorrow, so tune in tomorrow, okay? Oh, I was sending out some money orders to prisoners today, and it reminds me of one of our generous donators doubled his donation this month so that we could send some more money to Dennis Mahon. So instead of getting 25 this month, he's getting 50. So I think he'll be pretty happy with that.